All right. So who are you?
My name is Glenn Vanderburg. Mm-hmm. I am I don't quite say former Java developer. I was a Java developer primarily for a long time, and now I'm mostly doing Ruby work and some JavaScript and Ajax development training and everything. I'm strongly in the Ruby community and work for a company called Relevance in North Carolina. It's a U.S.-based consulting firm in Ruby and Rails and Agile practices and things of that nature.
Okay, so, you know, Ruby is definitely something that's very popular right now. And I guess you could say that, well, dynamic typing is popular as well. Can you explain to me, what is it that you love about Ruby? Just out of curiosity.
What I love about Ruby, and I think this, whenever any developer loves a programming language, part of it is it feels right to them. Mm-hmm. So I think there's some good arguments to be had about Ruby versus other things and mm-hmm. why Ruby's better in some technical sense. At the end of the day, it feels natural to me. I was talking with another Ruby guy earlier, Marcel Molina, and he reminded me that Matt's the designer of Ruby, said that one of his goals in designing Ruby was optimizing programmer joy, and which, you know, in some sense sounds weird, but to me as a programmer trying to choose a programming language, it certainly works out that way. Mm. I can be really productive in it, and well, here's just one example.
Sure.
I've always been really skeptical of tools and platforms and languages that claim to have a really huge increase in upfront productivity, because in my experience, a focus on getting things done fast up front leaves you with something that's difficult to maintain and enhance over time. So the cost per feature goes up, sometimes quite dramatically, pretty rapidly. Ruby and Rails offer pretty strong productivity improvements for programmers at the front of the project, but in my experience so far, that doesn't end up resulting in a poorly or weakly designed system that's hard to maintain and enhance later. So I really enjoy it.
Interesting. You could say the same thing for the .NET framework and C#, because it's really the framework that offers a lot of... So Ruby without Rails is less interesting.
Not to me.
Not to you. Okay, so you're language kind of focused.
Right. I love Rails, but one of the things I find remarkable is the design that the originator of Rails is the first one to tell you that Rails is as nice as it is because it's built on Ruby. And Ruby is a strong enabler of what Rails does.
Interesting. And so, you know, back to my side of the world, which, you know, is statically typed C# running on the CLR, which I think is, you know, some amazing technology. But that's the world that I live in, right? Channel 9 is a website that's written in C#.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there's JavaScript using, you know, we use it on the client, etc. Much prefer writing C# than I do JavaScript. That's my own personal opinion. So I kind of like the typed world, the static typing. I understand the benefits of... But let's talk a little bit about dynamic typing. What
I used to be a static typing proponent, really, really strongly. And and now I'm a strong dynamic typing proponent. I think... But really, I don't think there's one true way. I don't think dynamic typing is inherently, in any abstract sense, better than static typing. There's static typing the Java and C# way. There's also static typing the Haskell and OCaml and Erlang way, which is a bit different. And then there's dynamic typing. It's not sort of black and white or good versus evil. There are costs of each approach and benefits of each approach, and you have to look at your situations and weigh them and look at those costs and benefits and everything. And so I got interested in Ruby and I started learning it. And as a Java person and a static typing person, mm-hmm. I thought, well, I wouldn't use this for anything serious, but it sure is nice for little throwaway tasks and scripting and system administration work and project automation work and things like that. Mm-hmm. And this was about 2001. But through that, I worked with it a lot and started noticing that I never got typing errors in my code, and that sort of opened my eyes to the fact that I almost never got typing errors at compile time in my Java code either, and I started thinking about where errors come from in my code and what they do for me, and I'm a strong believer in test-driven development and unit testing, and static typing has some costs, mm-hmm. it has some benefits. In the Ruby world, we get to avoid the costs, and because we're believers, most of us, in strong unit testing anyway, mm-hmm. we get the same benefits and then some in another way.
Hmm.
It works very nicely.
So, I mean, when I think about, I mean, how does dynamic typing or dynamic languages like Ruby, how do you deal with collections? So, I mean, you could have a collection of anything, whereas...
Yeah.
You know, so in other words, you don't cast it.
No, right? You don't have to cast it.
So I guess what I'm trying to say is if you have a large collection of something,
yes,
there's going to be a cost associated with, at runtime, determining what that something is full of without any explicit. So that's kind of what I mean. Does explicit offer you a performance gain?
It can. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a lot of people have been taught to believe or somehow got the belief that dynamically typed languages are inherently slower.
Okay.
Today, at least, certainly true of Ruby, it's much slower than Java and it's much slower than C#. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's an inherent issue. It is true, however, that it's harder to make dynamically typed languages fast than it is statically typed languages. At the same time, it's been a long time since I've run into a problem that Ruby wasn't fast enough for.
Mm.
And also, these days, I've seen this over and over again, mm-hmm. our systems are big enough and complicated enough, and they generally have multiple layers and multiple processes involved, and spending time waiting on the database and waiting on the network. Mm-hmm. And with applications like that, you gain a lot more in terms of performance from architectural choices than you do from the speed of the language.
Okay. So, you know, a lot of the talk, and I was just talking with Joe Armstrong for a few hours.
Mm-hmm. Wish I'd been here for that.
Yeah, it would have been nice. If we had a good group of people, you would have added some real value.
I would have just liked to watch.
It was cool. Yeah, it was right outside this room.
Okay.
But, you know, clearly we're talking about the big thing now, obviously, is multi-core, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, without getting back into that whole thing, my question really is, you know, is there a relationship at all between dynamically typed languages and the way to target multi-core systems? I mean, is it easy for you to write functional in Ruby?
It's certainly easy to write code in a functional style in Ruby.
Okay.
However, when I say that, that's in a functional style like Lisp programmers would recognize it in a functional style. And languages like Erlang go a little farther. I already mentioned Haskell and Erlang, and mm-hmm. it's pure functional languages like that. And they are actually statically typed. And they're actually much stronger static typing than Java and C#.
Hmm.
At the same time, they do it with type inference, where you don't have to declare every type of everything. Usually the compiler can figure it out.
Hmm.
I think of static typing in those languages as static typing done the right way, where the costs are reduced, but the benefits are increased because the type system is stronger. And back to your question, those languages, because of their properties that go beyond functional programming in Lisp or what you could do in that style in Ruby or something like JavaScript. They have really strong enforceable properties of what functions are allowed to do, and that permits those languages and the compilers for those languages and runtimes to do very smart things about managing concurrency and splitting a problem into pieces and running it on multiple processors and dealing with that in a safe way. I think you could mimic a lot of Erlang's concurrency style in Ruby, and I suspect somebody will be working on doing that. But
why not just learn Erlang?
I am.
Okay.
I'm reading Joe's book right now, and I've been interested in that kind of language for a number of years now.
Interesting. So, I mean, it really brought up an interesting question in the sense that you have all of this just giant population of C# and Java and C++ and VB and static, giant, imperative language after another.
Right.
When in reality, those languages really aren't going to work on 64 cores without some serious help from the runtimes.
Mm-hmm.
And programmers are going to have to learn some new tricks, even if we add these functional constructs into those languages.
Yes,
so there's more learning for programmers.
Absolutely.
Soon.
And you know, you said why not just learn Erlang, and I certainly am. I'm a huge Ruby fan, and I love working in that language. I'm not religious about it, and I don't think it's the be all and end all. And I really hold to the pragmatic programmers' advice from a number of years ago about you should be constantly trying to learn new languages over time to make you a better programmer.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, and no offense to the Microsoft crowd, but that's why when I started to try to move on from Java, I didn't move to C#, because I wanted a language that was very different from what I was used to, so that it would teach me a new way of thinking about problems.
Interesting.
And really expand me as a programmer. And that's one of the reasons I'm looking at Erlang now, because Erlang's pretty difficult for an old procedural and object-oriented programmer to figure out, because it requires thinking about problems in a different way. So that makes it hard to learn, but I think that also makes it more valuable to learn, because it enlarges my brain more.
Cool. So now, because I come from the mothership, the Microsoft domain, and I'm of course very open-minded, and I don't walk around with a flag on. But I do believe that the CLR and associated functionality encapsulated in the BCL, and even C# and VB.NET, which is a very underappreciated language,
it's terrific technology.
Is very, very good technology. But if you really want to expand your mind on that stack, I'd recommend you check out F#.
Yes,
which
heard
also
great things about F#.
Yeah, you're gonna have to think a little differently, but you get the power of the BCL underneath you.
Yes,
and you're not writing C# or Java style syntax. So that's just something I'd throw out.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that.
But Erlang definitely sounds. I'm going to read his book as well after talking to him for so long.
It's very good.
Most interesting. So, what do you see as some of the biggest challenges besides multi-core for developers in the next couple of years? Is that the number one thing?
Well, I think that's a big one. The one thing that worries me, I've been a programmer long enough that I see we tend to move in cycles, and one of the cycles is that developers and development managers and our employers and customers don't really like how messy the practice of software development is, and sometimes unpredictable.
Yeah.
And so I think of it as often sort of wishful thinking involved. There's a tendency to want to try to figure it out and systematize it and make it rigid and predictable. And then we kind of fool ourselves into thinking we've done that, and we've figured out how to do it. And I think, looking back on the late 90s and the early part of this decade, in large enterprises, there was an idea that, okay, we figured out how to do this now, and serious enterprise software is, depending on your enterprise, which one you're in, is either done with .NET or it's done with Java, and that's how you do it, and you do it in this way and design it and work in this process. I think since then there's been a lot of upheaval, and none of that looks quite so certain anymore, and I think that's good, and I think we were a little too rigid and sort of blindly following a herd mentality. And there's a lot of great thinking that's improving the state of the art right now. But I also know that there's inevitably going to be pressure to let's standardize on some things again and figure out. And I'm worried that cycle will repeat itself. People ask me if I think Ruby's going to kill Java. And I say, well, no. And I don't think it should, not because it's not as good. I think it's just as good in certain situations. Java's better in other situations. But I think we all benefit from different ways of thinking about how to solve software problems and learning from each other. I'm excited to see how many web frameworks in many different languages are learning from the lessons that are in Rails. And then in the Ruby world, other frameworks in completely other domains, not just web development, are learning different lessons from the way Rails is done. And that's a sign of a healthy ecosystem, I think.
Very interesting. You did touch on something really at the very beginning, which is incredibly interesting. And in fact, it's something that Microsoft, I know, the senior engineering leadership, not the business people, they each have their very important roles for the company, obviously.
Right.
But in the senior leadership, the technical leadership area, they're really thinking hard about the notion of software composability. Because, you know, even Gates doesn't feel that software is a true engineering discipline.
Right.
And so it needs to become more composable. And so it's interesting when you think about a composable system that's not also object-oriented. But, you know, that's my own naivete.
Right.
Clearly, you can make a according to Joe, you can make a composable system in Erlang no problem by, you know.
There's an assumption here that that there's an assumption in that question that to be engineering requires that we understand composability, and that we've enabled that on, you know, some particular scale. I don't necessarily buy into that. I was really excited to go to a talk here at JAU by Kevlin Henney this morning called With Economy and Elegance. And he actually took that phrase from something that I'd discovered as well. It's I'm going to get the details wrong, but some structural engineering society and their definition of structural engineering. And it says, you know, the job of structural engineering is to build with economy and elegance structures with certain properties. And over the history of software development, whenever we've tried to talk about software engineering, and that field is very rightly concerned with how sloppy and unreliable software development is sometimes.
Certainly.
And they focus on what Kevlin says, and I agree, is a caricature of other mature engineering disciplines. And we tend to think of it as being all about robustness, all about correctness, all about predictability. But engineering also has to deal with questions of cost. And a lot of times when we talk about engineering in software, we ignore cost. We think about the right way, the perfect way, how can we improve this? And you have to weigh those. That's what our customers are really seeking from us, is figuring out economical ways of building good systems.
Sure.
So
that's a good point. Now, the only thing that that I would say, and I guess not retort, but sort of,
feel free,
would be that in software today, which if you look at it, if I want to remodel my bedroom, I have to take my house down, and then rebuild the house, and then add my new bedroom, because there's so many dependencies that I don't fully understand.
Right.
Or the house was just designed that way.
Yes.
Whereas in a strict engineering discipline, Could you imagine if they had to, you know, a new company goes and buys a floor of the of a large office building downtown. If they had to take the building down to move in the new company because they had a certain set of requirements. Right. That's kind of what I mean by composability.
Sure. Yeah.
And today in software, everybody, and it doesn't matter what language you're using, maybe it's just a design pattern.
There are systems that have the right characteristics of composability, mm-hmm. but we don't have a good understanding of how to arrive at designs like that. You're right.
Excellent. Well, hey, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And I'll probably see you again later around walking. So give me some feedback on this conference. Why did you come to the conference?
I came to Jauhu for the first time last year, mm-hmm. And I've been hearing about it from both Dave Thomas's and a few other people I know who've been coming here for a long time, Martin Fowler, about what a great conference it was. I was excited to come last year and really excited to get to chair the Ruby track this year.
Nice.
And it's a tremendous conference. They really know how to get a lot of interaction between the speakers and the conference attendees. And it's an ambitious conference. It's a practitioner's conference that's aimed at working programmers. But at the same time, there are some academics here talking about really cutting-edge things. And you want to strike the right balance, and I think they do. And they have a really well, because most of the people here have been coming to Jauhu for several years, they have a really well-educated set of attendees who are ready for more of that kind of thing. And it makes it a really forward-thinking and interesting and open-minded conference where people from different communities with very different views about how software should be done get together and talk, and that's a great thing.
Absolutely. I mean, look, I'm here from Microsoft,
mm-hmm.
and I've been meeting with lots of people.
Yeah, OO and functional people, and
it's a beautiful thing. Well, we're all in it together.
Yes.
Hey, great to meet you.
You too. Thanks, Charles.